There is a temptation to dismiss the pious Clinton as somewhat of a poser, seeking to cover up less righteous aspects of his life. But he was always a man of contrasts and contradictions. Within hours in one day, he could eat pork ribs and listen to the Delta blues music at Sims Barbecue in the lowlands of Little Rock's predominantly black South Side, then drive up to the Heights for a round of golf at the Country Club of Little Rock, an elite hideaway with manicured fairways and no black members. Then, on the way home, he might pop in his favorite tape of white Pentecostal gospel music from the Alexandria Sanctuary Chorale. Clinton could go from a meeting with deer hunters in Scott County, who were furious because the State Game and Fish Commission would not let them run their dogs in December, to an education summit in Charlottesville, staying up all night crafting an agenda of education goals for the 50 governors and the Bush administration, and then to a West Coast fundraising dinner at Norman Lear's house, where he mixed with a Hollywood glitterati. If Clinton had the ability to move easily through so many different worlds, he could also appear a chameleon, forced to balance one world off against another. Capable as he was of great bursts of energy and concentration, no single world could keep him content for long.
After nearly 8 years, the 8-year presidency of Bill Clinton may not have come into focus yet. And given Clinton's ability to change character to suit the situation, it's that much more difficult to assess the man. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
As the president at a time that seems almost idyllic in retrospect, Bill Clinton came across as pragmatic, shrewd, and congenial on one hand, and on the other, deceitful, sophomoric, and tragically flawed. What ambition propelled him to become governor of Arkansas at the age of 32 and president of the United States at 46? And what forces pushed him toward impeachment? Our guest is David Marinus, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of various books, including First in His Class, a 1995 biography of Bill Clinton.
Oh, welcome back to University of the Air.
Thanks, Emily and Norm.
In the preface to your book, First in His Class, you say that people are always asking you, so did you like Clinton or what do you think of Clinton? I mean, that's the kind of question a biographer gets asked, especially
yes.
about a living political figure. And you say you liked him when you disliked him and disliked him when you liked him. What exactly, when you started out your biography or when you think about Clinton today, what is your emotion toward him?
Well, you know, Emily, I wrote that preface 12 years ago. And I feel the same way about him today as I did then, essentially. There are aspects of Bill Clinton that are incredibly admirable. And there are aspects of him that are really infuriating. And there's a great temptation among people to either choose one or the other and say he's great or he's horrible, or wish that he were one or the other. And as a biographer studying his life so carefully, I came to appreciate the fact that they were inseparable, that the same impulses that made him potentially great also brought him back. And so I came to view him as that character, that flawed character with enormous appetites. And so that's why I say that even when he was doing something that I disliked in the book, I still had this larger sense of Clinton as a likable character. Or if he was doing something that I liked in the book, I still had the realization that that wasn't all there was to him.
This is regardless of politics?
It's including politics, but beyond politics. And generally speaking, Bill Clinton's personality and character and drive all were inseparable from politics. Almost everything he did was political in one sense or another. So,
in fact, that opening passage that you read, it seems to establish him as this quintessential politician that can be many things to many people, that that chameleon ability is what's required in politics, it seems.
Yeah, it is. It is one of the essential talents, for better or worse. I mean, there's some terrific people, leaders, who don't have that talent and will never be president. And perhaps Al Gore suffered from that somewhat, among others. But it is sort of the central talent of a politician. And my favorite story about Clinton and his ability to sort of adapt to his climate, wherever he was when he went to Georgetown University, a Catholic institution, taught there by Jesuits, And in his freshman year, one of the seminarians who was teaching an ethics course took him out for a hamburger and beer. And midway through their conversation, the point of it all came clear. And the seminarian said, Bill, you know, you really ought to think about going into the priesthood. And Clinton said, well, don't you have to be a Catholic first? But he had been such a good student and so adapted to the Jesuit way that the Jesuits thought he was one of them.
And that from somebody with that Pentecostal background.
Exactly, from Baptist Arkansas.
Well, let's take him back to the beginnings.
I never met my father. He was killed in a car wreck on a rainy road 3 months before I was born, driving from Chicago to Arkansas to see my mother. After that, my mother had to support us. So we lived with my grandparents while she went back to Louisiana to study nursing. I can still see her clearly tonight through the eyes of a three-year-old, kneeling at the railroad station and weeping as she put me back on the train to Arkansas with my grandmother. She endured that pain because she knew her sacrifice was the only way she could support me and give me a better life. My mother taught me. She taught me about family and hard work and sacrifice. She held steady through tragedy after tragedy, and she held our family, my brother and I, together through tough times. As a child, I watched her go off to work each day at a time when it wasn't always easy to be a working mother. As an adult, I've watched her fight off breast cancer. And again, she has taught me a lesson in courage. And always, always, she taught me to fight.
They made a lot during the campaign of coming from a town called Hope and
yes.
So on. But take us back to the time and place and family circumstances of his birth and how essential that is to who he became.
Well, in the campaign, they call him the man from Hope. In fact, he was the man from Hot Springs. But we'll get to that later. He was born in Hope, and he was born a fatherless son. Although in my book and in my research, I leave some ambiguity about his father and whether it really was his father, because there's some still unanswered questions about that. It appears that his father had only known his mother for a couple of months before he went off to World War II. William Jefferson Blythe was his name. And then shortly after he came back, he was killed in a car accident. And Billy was born in the meantime. So he grew up with his grandparents, and his mother and his grandmother were the two sort of defining influences in his earliest days. His mother, Virginia, was, who I got to know for a few years before she died, was an incredibly gregarious, freewheeling, unencumbered woman of many tastes. She loved to go to the racetrack. She'd spend an hour fixing her face before she'd appear in public. She wore tank tops around. She was an interesting character, sort of a classic Southern character that you'd love to write about in one of the books, fiction. His grandmother, Edith Cassidy, was sort of uptight, somewhat repressed, very metronomical in her taking care of Bill Clinton. So she would set alarm clocks to wake him up every few hours to feed him if Virginia was away. So you had these two different impulses going right at the beginning of Bill Clinton's life, one sort of determined and organized and one sort of freewheeling.
And do we see any kind of political soil here that Clinton, the young Billy Clinton, is coming out of?
A little more than he ever said during the campaign. He had an uncle who was in the state legislature, the man whose name he took, Clinton. Blythe died before he was born. His mother, when Billy was still a toddler, married Roger Clinton, who was kind of a ne'er-do-well, who had a job in his brother's car place down in Hope and then moved the family to Little Rock. Roger Clinton's brother was in the assembly, and there were some political connections there. But still, basically, if you had to pick a person who came out of nowhere to be president of the United States, Bill Clinton is right up there with Abraham Lincoln.
And if you look at the sense that he must have had growing up of being fatherless, you know, of lacking something,
yeah.
Do you see any of his enormous appetites that you talk about, or his ambition, or his, I don't know, desire for fame coming from any of that?
Well, I see more his desire not for fame at first, but for just some sort of appreciation, his need to be liked or loved, definitely coming from that lack of having a father in those early years. But just as formative was the fact that his stepfather, with whom he lived most of his young life, was an alcoholic and abusive. And so Clinton grew up with the classic characteristics of a child of an alcoholic parent, both the desire to be loved, the need to be a peacemaker, and an urge to go out into the world. Here's where the fame comes in, to go out into the world and redeem your family. All of those drives came more from his stepfather's alcoholism probably than his real father's death.
I'll fight to create high-paying jobs so that parents can afford to raise their children today. That's why I'm so committed to make sure every American gets the health care that saved my mother's life. And that women's health care gets the same attention as men's. That's why I'll fight to make sure women in this country receive respect and dignity, whether they work in the home, out of the home, or both.
He actually had to defend his mother sometimes from his stepfather. At least that's a story that got out.
It's a story Bill told during the campaign. I got all of the divorce documents, and clearly Roger Clinton at various times did beat his mother. I hate to generalize, but there was a lot of that going on in Hot Springs. There was a lot of duplicity among the men. A lot of them had mistresses. A lot of them beat their wives. It was part of that 1940s, 1950s Hot Springs reality. Women had to deal with a lot of bad things, and Virginia Kelly Clinton was one of those. So at age 14 or 15, Bill did step in a couple of times. The divorce papers don't quite present the scene quite with a dramatic flair that Bill himself would tell it during the campaign, but nonetheless, he did try to help his mom.
How was he reacting to the still, I guess, pretty solid South at this point?
Well, here you get to what I've always thought was the better side of Bill Clinton. He was a son of the New South right from the beginning, in the sense that for whatever reasons he was, and he takes it all the way back to his grandfather, who had a country store in Hope where a lot of the blacks in town would do their shopping. But Bill, from the earliest days, was really strong on race relations. And, you know, he grew up in the segregated South. His high school, Hot Springs High, was completely segregated. The swimming pool in town was segregated. As a teenager, he was part of a band that was integrated. He was very proud of that. He watched the 1957 Little Rock desegregation riots, white riot, on television and was influenced by that. So that by the time he was a junior in high school, when he went for his pilgrimage to Washington as a member of Boys Nation to meet John F. Kennedy, there was a lot of debate at that Boys Nation about issues involving race, and Clinton was one of the few Southerners who was on the side of civil rights.
And why do you think that is? I always wonder why it is that certain people are able to transcend the racism that surrounds them.
Yeah, it's an excellent question, Emily. As I said, some of it goes back to his grandfather.
Was he a reader, like an avid reader
Bill
as a child?
Bill was, absolutely. When did To Kill a Mockingbird come out? That was probably
50s. 50.
Yeah, 50. That was, he was probably already where he was by then. But he loved that book, you know. And he played the saxophone, so he was interested in jazz. Mm-hmm. And, you know, saxophone and jazz means black, basically. I think his mother was not a prejudiced person, and that combined with his grandfather shaped it a little bit. And then some aspects of why people think the way they do are inexplicable. But he had that from the beginning.
So what did he think of John F. Kennedy? Was it strictly a matter of idol worship for this young, what would he have been, 17-year-old?
He was 16. Absolutely. I mean, by then, his mother had been talking about how Billy was going to be president someday since he was in third grade.
Why? I mean, did she see
She saw gifts of a prodigy, which, you know, he wasn't in some ways, but he was in others. I mean, he had a charisma from an early, even though he, you know, in his first and second grade, he was, kind of thought himself as a tubby guy. By the time he got to junior high school, he had something. And he was a reader when no one else in the family was. He was incredibly articulate. He had that same ability to sort of synthesize information and say the right things at a pretty early age. He couldn't stand to be alone. He had a need to be with people. One of his childhood friends told him, David Leopoulos used to tell me, you know, I'd get a call on a Sunday morning and Clinton would say, come on over, I don't want to be alone. And David would just sit there while Clinton did the crossword puzzle, you know, not even talk to him. He just needed people around him. So anyway, all of that was part of Clinton. So he got to meet President Kennedy, who was a Democrat. Clinton was a Democrat, was, you know, handsome, everything that Clinton wanted to be. And the beginning of my book is about sort of Clinton making sure that he found a way to shake President Kennedy's hand.
And you said partly to please his mother.
His mother, absolutely. You know, Bill Clinton was a little bit below Elvis Presley in her book, but way up there.
And so this is a defining moment for Bill Clinton, and he moves on from there, or is this something in retrospect that he looked back and
it was a defining moment because it convinced him that he wanted to go back to Washington. And that took him to Georgetown, which took him into the world of government and politics, and it was one sort of continuum from there.
He's quoted as saying at one point that he was a good saxophone player, a good musician. He came out first in a state contest, but he thought he would not be as good as John Coltrane.
That's to say the least.
he said something of that effect in another pursuit where he thought he could be quite good, but not as good as the best. But he thought, on the other hand, that he could be a great politician or a great political force.
Later in his career, after he had lost his governor and was coming back, he gave a really incredible speech that I found where he was brutally honest about it all and said that politics was the only track he could run on.
But what about teaching? You do have him teaching for a while at Arkansas Law School. Right?
Yeah, well, that was teaching at Arkansas Law School. Also, you can learn a lot about Bill Clinton just by studying that little moment. In one sense, he was a fabulous teacher in that he cared about his students. This is in Fayetteville in 1973. When he got there, it was the first wave of black students in the law school. Almost all of them were failing. They had no mentors. Nobody really cared about them. They were, you know, the university let them into the school because everything was being desegregated, but they didn't really have anything support system. And Clinton became that support system and devoted himself every day to holding different study sessions with the black students. I went back and interviewed almost all of them, and they were incredible in their support of Clinton. They called him Wonder Boy. They said they never would have made it without him. At the same time, Clinton was kind of a lackadaisical teacher in every other respect. Twice he lost the entire papers that his whole class wrote, once on a plane to Washington, and another time he just couldn't find them. It's true that he gave the black students B's and A's because they earned them, but he gave everybody high grades. And partly because, you know, they'll all be voters in Arkansas someday. So you see a little bit of all of Clinton through that experience. Hillary came out to Arkansas a year later and was also a teacher there. And the other law professors respected Hillary tremendously. They thought she was organized, that she had a study plan. She followed the book. And she was sort of the opposite of Bill. And the students, you know, were a little more mixed in their feelings about her because she was a lot tougher.
And is that what attracted him to Hillary, do you think, that need for opposite? And for that matter, what would have attracted her to him?
Opposites attract is part of the answer. They met at Yale Law School. She was actually better known at the time that they met than he was. He had come back from being a Rhodes Scholar. She had gotten into Life magazine by giving a commencement address at Wellesley that was sort of labeled as kind of a statement of the counterculture of that moment. And there's sort of a mythology about how they met. But in any case, early on in their relationship, she was not wowed by him. You know, she would hear him talking about sort of pretending he was this country bumpkin. And she'd say, I'll get it off at Clinton. You know, I know that. And so that, you know, somebody who challenges him like that, he's immediately struck by. Plus, she was smarter than him in some ways, and that also impressed him a lot. And early on in their relationship, they shared a deep love of policy, of books, of movies, of just talking about life. And they saw that they could get places together that maybe they couldn't get to apart because of their different qualities. And I think that was true then, and it's true today. You know, for all that they've gone through, I think that that relationship still has certain benchmarks that are the same.
More on the life of Bill Clinton when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
With Bill Clinton, it is often tempting, but usually misleading, to try to separate the good from the bad, to say that the part of him that is indecisive, too eager to please, prone to deception, is more revealing of the inner man than the part of him that is indefatigable, intelligent, empathetic, and self-deprecating. They coexist. There's a similar balance to his life's progression. In his worst times, one can see the will to recover and the promise of redemption. In his best times, one could see the seeds of disaster.
David Marinus making some observations about Bill Clinton in his 1995 biography of Clinton. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, David Marinus, and our topic, the complex. One might say fascinating in some cases. One might say off-putting Bill Clinton, depending upon one's point of view. We've seen that he and Hillary are complementary forces, that they can do things together that neither one could do separately. Is she already feeding into his political ambitions at this point? And at what point do they decide that the governorship of Arkansas is a ripe plum for a 32-year-old?
Well, he started running for governor almost from the moment he moved back to Arkansas in 1973, certainly from the day after he lost his first election, which was for Congress up in northwest Arkansas in 1974. He was elected attorney general in 1976, and that was just a holding area, basically. He was called the governor-in-waiting, and he became the governor of Arkansas at age 32.
How did he pull that off?
Partly it was just luck that David Pryor was moving up to be a senator, and everybody knew Pryor, and the two key politicians in Arkansas then were David Pryor and Dale Bumpers, and they were both moving into the Senate. They both had known Clinton from the time he was just a kid working on a campaign in Arkansas, and everybody from the moment he lost that congressional race, because it was so close, saw him as the sort of chosen one. So he had an open field basically to run for governor, and he blew everybody away. And really became sort of, for a brief moment, a symbol of a new generation and a new way of looking at things. And that little piece I read was right before he became governor, because there was so much hope and optimism, and his first term was, in many ways, complete chaos.
And did the chaos, would you say, is he responsible for the chaos or just not really prepared?
I'd like to put this in the context of his first 2 years as president. He had a very ambitious agenda, both places. Didn't quite have the organizational skills, management skills to pull it off. As a president, people would often say he didn't have a real strong chief of staff and nobody knew who was running things within the White House. As governor, he literally didn't have a chief of staff, and he had three people who had various aspects of that position. But you can't blame it on the staff. And so Clinton, in that first 2 years as governor, made some really bad strategic mistakes. One was that he imposed a vehicle tax, which had a good intention. The tax was based on the weight of the car because that would be how much it would damage the highways.
Oh.
But all the poor people in Arkansas had these big old heavy clunkers.
Yeah.
So it had a negative effect in terms of progressive politics in that sense. And so he angered a lot of the poor people in Arkansas unwittingly. He had this, a habit which he maintained for the rest of his career and still has, of being late to everything and driving people crazy. You know, they'd be going to a meeting at the governor's mansion and Clinton would show up an hour later. It got so bad that at one point a man escaped from a local insane asylum and showed up at the Capitol building and said he was there to kill the governor. The police immediately apprehended him and sent a note up to the governor's office saying there's a man downstairs who just escaped from a loony bin and he said he's here to kill the governor. The note went to the appointment secretary who scratched in a little thing that said, see if you can fit this guy in. It was sort of macabre humor because Clinton was driving them so crazy at that point. I mean, they all loved him, which is not unlike what happened in the presidency. Most of the people that worked for Clinton admire the heck out of him in a lot of ways. You know, they'd never worked for somebody who had more ideas, who had more energy, who had more of an ability to pull things out of the fire. And yet he was frustrating. And that was true in those first 2 years as governor, which he lost. I mean, he was 34 years old and he was an ex-governor. He was the second youngest ex-governor in American history. I write in the book that he fit the classic definition of a Rhodes Scholar, which was a bright young man with a great future behind him.
Yeah. And what difference do you think it made that he came from Arkansas? And in other words, if we think of George Bush in Texas versus Bill Clinton in Arkansas, what about that state in particular matters to understanding Bill Clinton?
Well, it's an interesting thing because he's the only president ever to come from Arkansas. And it's an unlikely place for someone to come from. And I think it was to his advantage more than disadvantage. I think that, that whole mythology about hope, he turned to his advantage. More than that, he stood out from an early age. He was always a big fish in a small pond. I think that even on little things that grew into the bigger accumulation of Bill Clinton, like being a Rhodes Scholar, it was much easier to become a Rhodes Scholar from Arkansas than from Massachusetts or New York State.
And that has to do with the competition.
Right. So he was always able to turn that to his advantage. At Georgetown, at Yale Law School, he always sort of played off that Hope, Arkansas, big watermelons, country bumpkin routine to surprise people. And there is in Arkansas a natural ingratiating quality to a lot of the personalities from there that I think Clinton used more to his advantage than disadvantage. So, it doesn't have the grandiosity or hubris of Texas. You don't come out of Arkansas thinking that you're cocksure and can beat the world. But it gave him both this confidence because he'd excelled there and a drive to prove that this little state was something, that he was something.
Is this the point at which Whitewater comes in?
Whitewater came in during his early governorship, and it probably should have gone out there too, to tell you the truth. I mean, one of the larger – I mean, it revealed a little bit about them, but it was so much in the past. And so Arkansas that, I think that what happened to Whitewater in his presidency was a – pretty much of an injustice to
you think
to
it was overblown.
Very much so. Yeah.
You talk about how early on he had a index card file of people he met and notes about them, sort of the beginnings of the Friends of Bill idea.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Wherever he went in Arkansas, he would make sure to meet as many people as he could and to remember something about each one of them. He had a physical index card file. Friends would say that he'd be sleeping over at their house. He never slept. He'd be up at 2 o'clock at night, either calling somebody out in California or writing down names from slips of paper that he accumulated for a few days of everybody he'd met on the campaign trail or wherever he was. And he had them in index files that were alphabetized and very well organized, sort of from that grandmother's side of his personality. But he also had them in his brain. And I saw this in action when I was traveling with him when he was running for president – He has a near photographic memory. Not, I don't know whether there scientifically is such a thing, but in some aspects of his brain, he can remember anything. He can remember a telephone number that he hadn't dialed in 35 years. Somebody visited him in the White House, and he said, oh, let's call your parents. The number is 305, you know, and he remembered the number of a friend's parents. He could meet somebody once and then remember something about them 10, 20, 30 years later so that, you know, he could connect with probably 10 or 20,000 people that way, which is extraordinary. His index file had a few thousand names in it. His brain had many more than that.
And, of course, it helps to remember some of the more influential names.
Well, that's very true. And that was another aspect when he asked about how Arkansas shaped him. Arkansas basically was an oligarchy, a very old-fashioned southern oligarchy where a few people controlled everything. Tyson Chickens, the Stevens Investment Company, and a few of the lumber companies. And Clinton had to deal with them to survive. And he did it in ways that at times would frustrate someone who was progressive to see how he, you know, acceded to their demands. And sometimes he outsmarted them. But it was a constant presence in his political life.
He did win the governorship back.
He did, yes. And that was the key moment in his career. And what sets in motion that whole sensibility that I have about Clinton of loss and recovery. The most amazing recuperative skills of any politician I'd ever seen. He apologized for what he'd done wrong in the first term. And by the way, that notion of apology came from a consultant named Dick Morris who resurfaced in his presidency. He went around the state and asked everybody, thousands and thousands of people, what did I do? You know, what was wrong? You know, and he moped about it. He set his course and he lucked out in that the person he ran against 2 years later sort of wanted to yank Arkansas back into the 19th century with creationism and a lot of other things. And so Clinton was able to set up a sort of new Arkansas versus old Arkansas again and reinvent himself as somebody new and get the governorship back.
Came back better organized?
He came back with more political skills and developed what in the book I call the permanent campaign. Never again did he separate politics from governing.
And what about his relationship with women outside of his marriage, which, you know, that has sort of dogged him always?
Yeah,
and as somebody who investigated him, what did you find?
Well, at the beginning of the book, I say, you know, if you're looking for a sex book, go somewhere else. But it was an aspect of his personality and character and lapsed into his political life. And so that's where I dealt with it. What I found was that from the very beginning, before Hillary moved out to Arkansas in 1974 to live with him and then get married, she knew what he was like. That at the time he was running for Congress, he had another girlfriend in the campaign office there who would go out the back door when Hillary would come out the front door. So there were probably times when, like any human being, she didn't want to confront that, but she knew about it from the beginning. There were other important times in his career when it did intersect with politics. In 1988, he almost ran for president. He brought all of his supporters down to Arkansas for an announcement the next day. The night before, he met with his top aide, Betsy Wright, and someone else was in the room as well. And she had the guts to say, we have to go over a list of these women who might be trouble for you. And the next day, he decided not to run for president.
The problem being that he was having the affairs or the fact that these affairs were somehow compromising his ability to govern?
Well, that they could compromise his ability to win the presidency. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's sort of a complex situation. I mean, I think that once he became president, what developed, whether it was his fault or not, did compromise his ability to govern. And, you know, there were several points during that whole impeachment Lewinsky situation where in a perfect world he could have been a better president if he hadn't had to deal with that and all of its ramifications. So it did affect him in the end. I mean, you can blame it on society in part, but he's the one who, you know, went into it knowing what could happen.
I would have thought that for somebody that was as politically motivated as he was, that he would recognize this sort of vulnerability, the stupidity of, you know, kind of, you know, acting in ways that would ultimately bring him down.
Well, my feeling about that is I agree completely that here's somebody who's smart about everything else in the world except himself. That's not uncommon for people, first of all. Secondly, I think that over the course of his career in politics, he was such a good survivor that he started to feel that he was invulnerable.
How did he go about then in those intervening years between 88 and 92, putting those issues behind him and getting up the strength to run for president?
He really didn't put them behind him, but Hillary decided that it was worth it. And so once he knew he had Hillary totally on his side, not just to not leave him if those things came up, but to defend them and help attack the critics, that he felt he had the strength to do it. And it turned out to be true.
Who do you find him envying? You know, the way like Richard Nixon will envy the good looks of Kennedy or so on. Where would you see Clinton sort of looking at someone else and wishing he had what they had?
You know, I'm not sure about politicians, Kennedy to some extent, but I would look to other fields. I would say a great philosopher or actor or Coltrane. those are the places he would, you know, I mean, he would want to be some combination of Spencer Tracy and Warren Beatty or John Coltrane. But I think in terms of politics, he was really sort of setting his own course.
One sentence in the platform we built says it all. The most important family policy, urban policy, labor policy, minority policy, and foreign policy America can have is an expanding entrepreneurial economy of high-wage, high-skilled jobs. And so, in the name of all those who do the work, pay the taxes, raise the kids, and play by the rules, in the name of the hardworking Americans who make up our forgotten middle class, I proudly accept your nomination for President of the United States.
When that 92 election came along and he's running against an incumbent, George Bush Sr., how far apart are the party platforms in 1992?
Well, it's more of a... I mean, on certain culture issues, they are, as always, further apart, you know, in terms of abortion and civil rights and some of the issues that have sort of separated, definingly separated the parties over the last 30 years. In foreign policy, it's hard to say. I mean, in some ways, the Clinton-Gore campaign was trying to be tougher on foreign policy than Bush was.
Bush had already prosecuted a war in the Persian Gulf.
He had, but, you know, in terms of Yugoslavia breaking up and Kosovo and all that, they were pushing for more action than he was taking.
Against the ethnic cleansing.
Yeah. But it was more, you know, I mean, as James Carville said, the economy's stupid. And that's where Clinton, you know, focused most of his campaign on you know, the disparity between rich and poor in the country. And, well, he would call it the middle class and the rich. And some of that is platform. Some of it is just sort of sensibility.
And Bush Sr. seemed to kind of implode anyway.
He certainly did, from an 88% approval rating to losing the election in 2 years is kind of stunning. And Clinton ran a brilliant campaign. Choosing Al Gore was a central part of that, which went against sort of the traditional
instincts. Yes, you got two Southerners. Yeah.
Two Southerners who were very much alike in terms of their sort of centrist to moderate. The interesting thing is that Clinton was always sort of, because of Hillary and because of his past and his anti-war activities such as they were, and because the right wing hated him so much, he and Hillary were sort of portrayed as these leftists. They never were even close to that. Not Hillary either. They were always totally pragmatic. And Al Gore, because he was the founder of the DLC, the sort of the moderate to conservative wing of the Democratic Party was seen as more of a centrist, and he was always much more to the left. There was a total misreading of all of them. But together, there was a certain magic that from the moment they left that convention in New York and got on those buses, the four young people out there in the country, it was like rock stars. And that really, the campaign was over from that moment in a sense.
The later and current years of Bill Clinton when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. When you visit any WPR sponsors, please let them know that you appreciate their support of this station.
Governor Clinton was a creature of habit. When someone went in to brief him on the subject or upcoming event, his habit was to keep doing some other activity, either reading or writing, at the same time that he was being briefed. Every half minute or so, without looking at the aide, he would blurt out, "What else?" Not as a question, but as a sign that he had cataloged the information and it was time to move on. They were two of Clinton's most frequently uttered words, "What else? What else? What else?" He was always working the telephone in search of inside information, much like his friend Jim Blair, who sought constant reports on cattle futures, only Clinton wanted the latest reading on Clinton political futures, up or down. He would end many conversations with another of his favorite phrases, "Keep your ear to the ground." He was a young man of oversized appetites. Any aide who spent time with him could tell stories of his inhaling apples in a few massive bites, swallowing them core and all. Hot dogs went down so fast they barely touched his teeth. The mansion cook could not bake chocolate chip cookies fast enough. Plates of enchiladas and nachos disappeared in seconds. What else? What else? What else?
That's David Marinus reading from his biography of Bill Clinton called First in His Class. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is David Marinus, and we're talking about Bill Clinton. So this man of oversized appetites who's always asking what else, he's president now. The first couple of years you're talking about, he's tried too many things, kind of as he did as a governor. What else starts to define the Clinton presidency, make it different from any other presidency?
Well, after those 2 years, which ended with him losing the most important political, or I should say policy, initiative of his presidency to reform health care and bring it to more Americans, very, very important thing that they lost. And the tendency is to blame it on Hillary and her, you know, task force. In fact, they were facing enormous odds and massive amounts of lobbying money from the other side, from the insurance companies. So I give them a little bit more on that one in terms of their effort, although it was mishandled. Anyway, after that, he essentially lost the presidency. The way I define it is that every 2 years, Bill Clinton had been running for something since he was 30 years old. And it was a two-year process, 2 years of his presidency, and the Republicans win Congress. Newt Gingrich asserts himself as the new leader of the country. Clinton has to claim that he's still relevant. And he spends the next 2 years almost the same way he did when he was out of the governorship for 2 years, sort of figuring out how to get it back. And once again, he lucked out in that he found that he would be running against someone who he could portray as part of the 19th century instead of the 21st.
Bob Dole.
Through no fault of Dole's, he was just an older man and didn't have that sort of energy and so on. And Clinton, when he came up with the idea of the bridge to the 21st century, sort of had it. Then he was on top again. And as I read before, whenever he's on top, you see the seeds of disaster. I remember very vividly, shortly after he won re-election, speaking at a conference in Washington and saying, "I don't know what's coming, but I know something bad is coming. I know this man too well, and he's on top, and something's going to bring him down, and then he'll figure his way out of that and get back again." I didn't know about Monica Lewinsky or, you know, Paula Jones, and that it would be the sex aspect of his life that would get him into trouble, but there it came.
Good evening. This afternoon in this room, from this chair, I testified before the Office of Independent Counsel and the grand jury. I answered their questions truthfully, including questions about my private life, questions no American citizen would ever want to answer. Still, I must take complete responsibility for all my actions, both public and private. And that is why I am speaking to you tonight. As you know, in a deposition in January, I was asked questions about my relationship with Monica Lewinsky. While my answers were legally accurate, I did not volunteer information. Indeed, I did have a relationship with Ms. Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong. It constituted a critical lapse in judgment and a personal failure on my part, for which I am solely and completely responsible.
You know, in a way, it's kind of like Nixon with Watergate. I mean, he had it made in the shade, and then he pulls something that's so stupid that you almost wonder if it's not purely self-destructive.
Well, the one of the many ironies of the Lewinsky scandal as it unfolded was that Clinton really got his presidency back when the Republicans overreached, and shut the government down. They thought they had the public with them, and they didn't. And it was a classic case of their hubris. It was during those late nights when they were figuring out how to outsmart the Republicans that Clinton started dallying with this young intern. So, yes, it does have those commonalities with Richard Nixon, on a much less important level, though. And everything in history has to be seen in relative terms, I think. And so when you compare the Clinton scandal, quote-unquote, and what led to his impeachment with matters of life and death that other presidents get us involved in, it sort of takes on a different tinge.
One of the Russian political figures of the day said something like, boy, we wish we had problems like that.
Yes.
It's such a minor thing.
And how did you see Clinton handling the sorts of scandal and stress? In other words, when you would see him go on TV, or when, you know, those famous where I did not have sexual relations, or the times you would see him, what did you pick up on from your sort of knowledge of him in terms of
how
he was handling it?
Well, sort of complex feelings about it. You know, he was lying. Maybe he felt he had to survive. Maybe he had sort of let himself into that corner. I knew he would figure out his way back, but there was a disappointing tendency that one could see about the Clintons to try to repress things as opposed to facing them in their reality. And I think it's a reflective of this constant, the permanent campaign and this feeling that people are out to get them and they'll do what they have to take to survive. Now, in some ways in politics, that's admirable. He didn't cave. You know, he didn't give up and he found his way back, and his presidency was in its totality better than a lot of other presidencies. And in retrospect, most people would probably say now that the impeachment wasn't worth it. The public said that from the beginning. I've always wanted to go back and interview all of the Republicans in the Congress then and say, do you think that what you did was worth it in retrospect?
What made them so eager to impeach him? What
they hated his guts.
Yeah, and why?
Well, from my study of Clinton, there's two factors involved. One is something about him. He's always driven conservatives crazy. From the moment he ran for Congress in 1974, there were Baptist ministers from the pulpit, you know, portraying him as a libertine or a homosexual or both. Or, you know, it's just incredible. He had sort of this character, you know, that where it just attracted that sort of stuff. Most of the rumors always were wrong and the characterizations wrong, but there's always enough of, you know, to allow them to enter in. I think part of it was that Clinton was so good at sort of co-opting conservatives on their own issues. He knew the scriptures better than most of the ministers who were denouncing him. He figured out how to take the Republican issues like welfare and balancing the budget and so on and co-opt the Republicans on that stuff. That drove them crazy. And he gave them enough of his own personality of that sort of what one conservative editorialist in Arkansas called Slick Willie, which sort of caught, to further that image and drive them even more crazy. But they couldn't beat him.
So it was really more personal than political opposition.
Well, that aspect of it was personal, but it came in the context of a changing society where Clinton wasn't responsible for sort of the disintegration of the parties, the more personality, celebrity-centric culture that he lived through and sort of went right through the heart of it, the gauntlet of it. So that was happening at the same time that he was allowing these or showing his own vulnerabilities.
What role did religion play in his actions? I mean, did he see himself as a sinner? You know,
yes.
If you think back to Jimmy Carter talking about lusting in his heart and so on. But in Bill Clinton's own mind, in terms of his own understanding of his behavior and what happened, how did he see himself and how did religion
figure? I think, you know, I think that Clinton from an early age started going to church when no one else in his family did. He's always searched for mentors in the Baptist church or elsewhere. I don't deny him that aspect of his personality. But I also think that he loved being a Baptist because he could wake up every day and forgive everyone else and then forgive himself and sort of renew every day. And that was an important part of his religion, was forgiveness.
This was a time, it seemed to me in particular, when you had a lot of these televangelists, you know, tearfully confessing to one sin or another on in front of their congregations. It
yeah.
seemed to fit in right well with all
but
that.
He did not tearfully confess.
I don't remember him tearfully doing much of anything.
No. You don't.
When did tears come?
Well, they would come in other situations. I saw him crying once out in Los Angeles when he gave a seminal speech on AIDS, saying that he would give up his life, you know, if he could stop this scourge. That was during the 92 campaign.
And that was genuine tears, not...
Well, they were real tears. No, I don't know how genuine they were because his actual policy on AIDS did not exactly please all of the leaders of the movement. I saw him in tears once in a black church, and I think that was just part of the emotion of the moment. I never saw him in tears sort of about his own life.
As he gets to the end of his presidency, and we have 8 years to look back on, success stories, promises delivered?
Well, the economy was, for the most part, excellent during Clinton's 8 years.
A budget surplus, hard to believe.
Yeah, it really is. Now, you can look back on it with wistfulness. It's a question about whether history will say that was had any lasting impact. I mean, the surpluses are long gone. I think that similarly, Clinton figured out how a moderate centrist to slightly to the progressive politician could succeed in the modern American culture. He didn't necessarily transfer that to his party, though. So, you know, the legacy of the party suffered some from that. He was pretty much of a sort of Eisenhower Republican on issues of free trade and welfare reform and, you know, very moderate. And those things were changed during his presidency. The legacy of those is still up in the air in terms of whether they helped or hurt the country. But what Clinton gave, despite all of the hostility towards him, he had a true sense of optimism, and he was able to convey that in a way that is hard to measure for people who feel that they're not totally part of the system. The effect that he had on African Americans in terms of just caring about them and doing symbolic things are important and more important probably than a lot of people realize and making people feel that they're part of the community. And I think that Clinton had that and that can't be just sort of dismissed or underestimated in terms of its importance.
Oh, I'll have to have you in later and see what comes for Clinton in the years that are ahead of him.
The Clintons, you might even say.
David Marinus has been our guest. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.